Welcome to the Cohort Sisters podcast, where we bring to life the stories, struggles, and successes of Black women navigating doctoral degree programs and their lives beyond the degree. I'm your host and the founder of Cohort Sisters, Dr. Ijeoma Kola. Cohort Sisters is an online global network empowering Black women pursuing doctoral degrees by providing resources, mentorship, and community. For more information, please visit our website at cohortsisters.com. You're listening to episode 5 of the Cohort Sisters podcast. I'm so excited about this episode because I catch up with Dr. Amber Spry, who I've known since way back in college when we did a summer research program together called Leadership Academy. Dr. Spry received her PhD in political science from Columbia University and is now an assistant professor at Brandeis University. She shares really critical insight on how you can create your own professional narrative during graduate school, how to do independent research consulting while getting your doctorate, and how to navigate the informal relationships necessary for academic and professional success. Let's get into our conversation. So thank you for joining us on the Cohort Sisters podcast. We like to start every podcast by just asking people to tell us about themselves. So tell us about yourself and who you are outside of your work.
I actually really like my life outside of work. I'm Amber. I grew up in Maryland and then lived in New York for about 10 years before relocating to Boston. I'm just a person who likes a balanced life as much as I can achieve that. So I cook a lot. I think that's one of the ways that I care for myself and the people around me is like making meals. I think of food as nourishment, and I'm always thinking about how to nourish myself, not just with food itself, but in the process of cooking. That's one of my favorite ways to connect with people and share with people. And it's been cool to think about what that means in a pandemic setting where I can't have people at my house, but how do I still extend care and love? I am into crochet right now, and that's my other big thing. I think I tend to be a person who fixates on thoughts, so now I've found a habit that lets me fixate on small, minute details. This is a question I ask in my research a lot. I ask people to describe themselves, and it's funny to have that question turned on me. I find a lot of purpose in my life in helping other people to feel purpose in theirs. So when people ask me how I describe my career and how I describe myself outside of my career, I think in all those spaces, I feel like a door holder.
I love that analogy. So as a door holder, what is your main job? What do you currently do?
I'm an assistant professor at Brandeis, and I have a joint appointment in the Department of Politics and African American Studies. So my book project that I'm working on right now deals with how our identities shape our political attitudes and behaviors. One of the things that I do in this work is complicate why we make the assumptions that we make about groups' political views. Why is it that pundits and politicians and researchers so easily assume that Black Americans vote overwhelmingly as Democrats, for example? Or why do evangelicals overwhelmingly vote for whoever is the conservative candidate? My work starts to complicate some of those narratives and show some of the nuances in identity and why we can't necessarily take all of those group labels at face value because there's so much more going on behind the scenes. I do that in a couple of ways. One is theoretically, I think about what is the context and contours of identity and what are the links between identity and attitudes. But then I also have a methodological approach. So I am coming in as someone trained in political methodology, thinking about how do we find new ways to measure identity. If we keep using the same check boxes for everything, we're going to get the same assumptions and make the same assumptions for everything. But if we give people new ways of expressing who they are in their relationship to the social world, my work shows that we might uncover new information that we would have taken for granted otherwise.
That makes a lot of sense. So as a political scientist, you have been very busy. How much of the current political state impacts the work that you do? How does the political news cycle impact your work as an academic?
My work deals with current U.S. politics. Because I do survey research, a lot of the work that I'm doing deals with, you know, how are people's attitudes changing in real time? And it's exhausting keeping up with this current cycle. There's a survey that we put in the field just recently, and we had to keep delaying it. It was meant to have gone out after the 2020 election. And then there was all this uproar about whether there was election fraud and whether it was going to be a contested election. And we had to wait another wave because we thought maybe we want to put some extra questions about that. There was all this talk about whether there was going to be some kind of situation happening at inauguration. And then we had to wait some more. So it's finally in the field. But all that to say, yeah, I'm always digesting politics in real time. And my work is always responding.
I know that for me, I get very mentally exhausted with politics, and I'm not even currently in the US. So how are you able to absorb what's happening politically, analyze it from an academic standpoint, but also maintain some distance from it emotionally? Is that even possible? I'm assuming not, but how do you contend with the fact that you're researching things that can also impact you emotionally?
It's hard, and I don't think I do this well all the time. For a long time, I would go to family functions and tell people that I'm a statistician because I just didn't want to talk about politics at the dinner table. And especially for me, it's hard because I do care really deeply about having these conversations in the communities where my work can potentially have the greatest impacts. But sometimes I don't have the emotional capacity to respond to it in my personal life. And so I think the best that I can do right now for myself is I have limits. I don't watch the news after 5 o'clock because the news is part of my work day. I have been really intentional, even on Instagram and social media, because a lot of my friends do this kind of work as well. So I have to work extra hard to like and bookmark the accounts with pictures of puppies and people making cupcakes, stuff like that. I have to be mindful all the time of what content is coming in front of me because it is hard. For some really lucky people, politics gets to be a thing that you observe and you engage when you want to. But for others of us, politics is something that we're constantly working to reduce active harm. Thinking about my positionality in the world as a Black woman with a Black father, with a family, I'm always thinking about what are the implications of these policies for real life and how do I help the people that I love think about these things. And one way that I'm learning how to be okay is that I do have those conversations through my work. I do work hard to make that work accessible to the communities I care about. And so it's a little easier in that way to justify the personal boundaries. Although part of me questions why I feel like I have to justify that, right? Like, why do I feel like I have to justify a personal boundary? But that's what helps me right now.
Absolutely. So let's go a little bit back. Let's talk about how you ended up in a doctoral program. The listeners don't know this. So we go way back. We did a summer program together called Leadership Academy. That's where we first met. But I'm curious, tell me about even before then. How did you get interested in doctoral level research? How did you get interested in political science even?
So I've always cared about power. And I always tell people politics is not necessarily policy. Politics is about power, right? One of the classic definitions of politics is who gets what, when, and how. And I really care about how power gets exchanged in the world. But that's not what I started out studying. So I grew up in a really musical family. My sister is an actor. I grew up doing a lot of singing, and I actually went to college on a music scholarship. And I would do gigs here and there in college to just make extra cash. To be honest, wasn't super engaged as a music major. I had gotten into a different college, but I didn't get the scholarship to go there. And I wound up going to the place that gave me a free ride. And I also had a music scholarship at this other school. It was a state college. I went to UMBC. I'm incredibly proud. I consider that my intellectual home. But I was really resistant to going to UMBC at first because I wanted to go to this school that I thought had this different caliber. But it wound up being the best decision I could have made as a 17-year-old. We had a family friend who happened to be close to the president of UMBC. And she said, I really think you should consider this. Come to this event with me. I want you to meet the president of UMBC and maybe he'll change your mind. So I go to this event. It's at the president's house. And I'm sitting there talking to Dr. Freeman Hrabowski. And I remember this clear as day because I was so shocked. But he said, if you come to UMBC, I will make sure you're taken care of, and I will personally mentor you throughout your experience here. And he kept every word of that promise. And I still, to this day, call Dr. Hrabowski my mentor. I'm so lucky to have had this person in my corner, but he's the reason I was at UMBC, and it changed my life. But I was a music major, and I didn't fully engage, and I would gig, and I wound up performing at the Democratic National Convention in 2008 with this group. I don't even remember how we wound up there. We just were this group that was singing and we got invited. And I remember being at this event and I was captured by the energy of what was happening around me. Because remember, this is 2008. So this is the year that Barack Obama was nominated for president. Hillary Clinton was running on the Democratic ticket. Sarah Palin was on the Republican ticket. People were talking about youth voters in a way that just was not something I had experienced in my political socialization. They were talking about race in politics. We were talking about gender in politics. And I was so overwhelmed. And I remember asking questions of anybody who would listen. And finally, someone said, well, you know, there's a career where you can ask questions for a living. And I said, I want to do that now. That was a turning point for me. This event that I was at because I was supposed to be performing wound up being the event that sparked my interest in politics. And I changed my major. And shortly after, I started working at a think tank. And I decided I wanted more control and more flexibility in the work that I was doing. And that's how I wound up deciding to get a PhD. And I haven't looked back.
That is so cool. I actually did not know that story. I'm so glad that you told it. The fact that you were a music major and then completely switched because of basically a happenstance occurrence of you ending up at the DNC, but also at a really critical political moment in our lives. That was also the first year that we were voting. For me, at least, that was the first year that I even thought about politics because all of a sudden I could vote. So my opinion could matter in some kind of way. So it's just really interesting that all of that intersected all at the same time.
It was crazy.
So you went to Columbia. Talk a little bit about how you decided that Columbia was the right program for you, was the right school for you, if it was the right school for you.
You and I both did this summer research program at Columbia as undergraduates. That's when we met. I think I might have been in my sophomore or junior year. And I wouldn't probably have thought to apply to Columbia for graduate school if my mentor in that undergraduate research program hadn't said to me, you really belong in this program, and I really think that you should do this. And if you want to apply to grad school, I want to write your letters. I was in the unique position where someone was offering to write my letters and offering to be my advisor. And so I applied to just a handful of schools, and Columbia was probably the most competitive school that I applied to because at the time I thought I wanted to stay close to where I grew up. And I just applied to Columbia thinking, we'll see, maybe. And that's the only program I got into. So I went to Columbia almost by default. But I think these happenstance things that have shaped my life, I'm really grateful for as far as graduate school experiences go, because they can be so fraught. In the spectrum of things, I think I had a relatively good experience at Columbia. I had two really great advisors. I knew that I wanted to do work that I cared about, but I didn't want to live in a really boring place. So I was happy to be in New York City. And that was a big reason why I think that was a good place for me as well.
So can we talk a little bit about your advisors? Did you seek them out on your own? Were you just paired with the right people by the program?
both of my advisors approached me. This is unusual in graduate school in general. I think it's especially unusual for women of color to feel like they're the ones being sought out in a graduate program. So my advisor initially was the person who invited me to apply to the program, and he had a lot to do with my interest in coming to Columbia. The advisor who chaired my dissertation committee came to Columbia maybe in my second year in the program. And I guess he came into Columbia and was asking around who's working on what and what kind of interesting things are graduate students working on. And he pulled me aside at one of these department functions where everybody's milling around. And he said, Amber, I've heard a lot of really cool things about your research, and I'm wondering if you want to work with me. I think that the methodological approaches that I take in research could be really cool if applied to your project, and we could talk about it. You let me know what you think. That was a really welcome conversation for me, especially because I was really sensitive at that point. I was in my second or third year. I didn't have leverage in the dynamics of how power works as a graduate student. And so I sort of was at that point starting from scratch with my research ideas. So for this advisor to come along and say, I want to mentor you and give you the tools to do what you want to do was really great. I didn't have advisors that most people think should be the natural advisors to my project. So I was doing work on identity and political psychology. So in that sense, working with faculty advisors who did political behavior and methods research made a lot of sense to me, but to people looking at me and assuming that identity means I study race, or assuming that identity means I study Black people, they thought that my advisors should be different advisors because my advisors were not people of color, but I had advisors who believed in the work that I was doing. And I think that was the biggest thing, is that they weren't perfect advisors. And they didn't understand some of my experiences in graduate school. And so I had to be really proactive as a graduate student about finding mentorship for all the different areas where I would need it. But I did have advisors who had my back. And I had advisors who would pick up the phone and say, hey, colleague at MIT, I have this student, Amber Spry, who would be a really great candidate for that doctoral fellowship. No one has perfect advisors. No matter who's doing your advising in graduate school, it's important to map out the areas where you need mentorship and not expect one person to fill all those different roles.
I'm glad you talked about the power dynamics of being a graduate student, because that's one thing that I had no idea going into graduate school. One, just as a graduate student, but then on top of that, being a woman, and then on top of that, being a woman of color. So feel free to talk about that a little bit more if you want. But then another thing that you talked about that I thought was interesting was this idea that you don't have to have a Black mentor. And so there are many people who are in cohort systems, and one of the reasons that they say they haven't necessarily applied to a program is because they're looking for a Black female mentor. And the fact of the matter is there are only like 5 of us out there. So you're not likely going to find a person who looks like you, but that doesn't mean that someone who doesn't look like you won't be a good mentor. So I'm glad that you brought up the fact that you had mentors who weren't people of color, but they did a pretty good job mentoring and advising you because they, one, gave you what you needed, and you also had the self-awareness to know what kind of mentorship you needed from them. They were just in your corner, and that doesn't come with skin tone. That comes with just good mentorship. And the third thing that you brought up that I really enjoyed was this idea that people assume that because you study identity, you study race. People often will try to box us into what they think that we should be doing based on their perception of us. Although I do study race in my work, I've come across other Black scholars who don't specifically study race, but everyone just assumes that all that we're going to do is study Black people and study race. And even if that was all we were going to do, it needs to be studied. So it's okay. But the fact that people will put you into a box and sometimes dismiss you just because of what they think that you're interested in, what they think that you're going to study. So those are just 3 things that I picked up from what you just said. You're welcome to, you know, add on anything in any of those directions or something else.
So with the power dynamic, it took me a long time to realize I get to decide how I leverage power. There is a hierarchy in graduate programs, and some places that hierarchy is more explicit than others. And I think how permeable those boundaries are maybe changes from program to program, but the hierarchy exists no matter where you are. Your advisors can tell you to call them by their first name. Everybody can be on a buddy-buddy basis. But at the end of the day, people in that faculty are going to sit in a room and deliberate about who the strongest doctoral students are. They talk about your files at the end of every year. There are so many things that people didn't tell me before I was in graduate school. And now that I'm a faculty member on the other side, there's no reason why this can't be transparent. There's no reason why graduate students shouldn't know that your file is being evaluated not just by your faculty advisor, but by everybody in the department. And it matters who's speaking up for you behind closed doors. I realized that I had a lot more control over my own narrative than I gave myself credit for. And so I just turned the situation into one where I was proactive about crafting my own narrative as a scholar. I told people who I am. I was really deliberate about my self-presentation. And yes, it is so much extra work, and it's unfair because there are graduate students who don't look like me who didn't have to do that, because people fill in the gaps for them. And that's the bottom line. There are some people for whom the benefit of the doubt is always available, and those gaps are always filled in. I knew that I didn't have that unless I put the words in people's mouths. So in my year-end reports, I told people exactly what I wanted them to say about me in that meeting when I wasn't there. I am actively applying for fellowships. I am seeking opportunities to publish my work. I put everything that I wanted people to say about me, I made it available for them to say. And that really helped me get over feeling like I didn't have the power to figure out how people were perceiving me in my program. So that's that first train of thought. The second one was about how do you figure out who your mentors are, and do your mentors have to look like you? I think the most important thing for me, and this is the advice that I give to people, is you actually have to teach people how to mentor you, especially as a Black woman. At least in my subfield of American politics, there was one Black woman in our entire department of more than 20 faculty members, but she was in a different field. She was on my dissertation committee, but just wasn't someone who would have been principally advising my work. And so I didn't have available at this institution the luxury of a mentor who looked like me or who could understand my experiences. And what I want people to understand is so much of the way that you advance in graduate school has to do with informal relationships. And that's one of the reasons that Black women feel like we want a mentor who looks like us and understands our experience. It is not necessarily because we feel like white men have that, so we want that too. It's because the opportunities that come about in graduate school are often forged through informal networks. The extent to which your advisor is willing to pick up the phone and make that phone call. If you're having drinks after a conference and the people who are at that table are talking about publication opportunities or research collaborations, if you're not at that table, you're not in that conversation about who's going to publish together. And that's how some people advance more quickly, is they just have those networks. And people are human, and I think it's a natural human proclivity to gravitate towards people who you assume have a similar set of background experiences. That's where implicit bias really has an effect on a graduate student experience. Not every woman wants to go have drinks at 9 o'clock at night after a conference, right? Not every Black woman wants to go have coffee on the roof deck at some conference. Not everybody feels that same level of safety to have one-on-one meetings outside of an office setting. But so many of these things happen in those spaces. So you have to teach people how to mentor you. And that's so important. If you know that there are spaces where you feel more comfortable, say that I would love to have a meeting here at this time. If you're looking for a specific kind of experience, you can't assume that someone else knows that's the experience you're looking for. So again, it goes back to crafting your own narrative about who you are as a graduate student, but it's also about figuring out how can you replicate that informal process in a way that works for your experience. And again, it's extra work. It's hard to do. But if you want to advance, it's one of those things that if I were writing the graduate school cheat code, that would be the biggest one on there. You have to figure out how to leverage what takes place informally in a way that's accessible to you. And part of it is just that not everybody knows what's going on informally. Not everybody knows that these guys aren't good at statistics. They just meet together to do the problem sets, right? These guys aren't necessarily better at publication than you. They're just publishing together. Get your own group, get your own network, get your own girls to write and collaborate and push each other through that publication process. You can do it. You can get there. But thinking about myself as a door holder, I'm like, we have to expose what's going on behind the scenes so that everybody can access those systems that help to get people advanced.
So, you know what's funny? People always talk about the power and importance of informal networking in corporate America. Like, how do you move up in corporate America? It's not your resume. It's really just being at those meetings that are happening at 9 p.m., like at a bar. But I literally have never heard anyone talk about that in terms of graduate school. But you're totally right. There are so many conferences that I've gone to, and after the conference was over, I went back to my hotel room. I did not socialize with anybody, did not go for drinks, did not do the rooftop, whatever. And you're right. That's when stuff happens. That's when collaborations happen. That's when ideas are shared and exchanged. And if you're missing out on those opportunities, then you definitely have to figure out a way to recreate those informal networks and opportunities for yourself outside of those spaces. So I think it's also okay to acknowledge that you're not comfortable, because we shouldn't force ourselves into spaces where we're not comfortable or spaces where we're not welcome. But we do, unfortunately, need to do the extra work to make sure that people are saying our names in other spaces, even if we're not there in the main space.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, right, what determines whether someone is on the short list of candidates for a postdoc or for a tenure track job or for an opportunity at a research institution? There's so little that separates candidates at the top. Everybody's resume looks amazing. Everybody's CV has really cool stuff on it. Everybody's come from a really great place or has been doing really compelling research. Those candidates at the top are really similar. And so what separates candidates when it's time to make a decision is, who do we know who can say something to me? People are looking for shortcuts. People are always looking for how to make the best decision they can make with the least information that they have in a way that puts them the best off in the future. They have very little information. They have to make a decision that's going to impact for a long time. And they're looking for a way to do that. And the way that a lot of people do that is by relying on their informal networks. They're looking at, who wrote that letter? Or actually, my colleague over at so-and-so gave me a call and told me this candidate would be great. It's a process that's full of bias. But if there is anything redeeming about it, it's that it doesn't have to be a secret to us. It doesn't have to be something that we just are totally mystified. Like, why are Black women political scientists only 1% of the discipline? This doesn't have to be mystifying to us. We know how these decisions are being made. So now let's open up the hood and tinker with the parts and make sure that the process is one that can be inclusive and mindful to us.
So now I want to shift a little bit and talk about the financial aspect of graduate school. We've talked about the mentorship. We've talked about some of the behind the scenes information that we often don't know. Let's talk about the money. How was your program funded? How was your degree funded? Did you get outside scholarships? And did you work outside of your program?
All of the above. My program, at least at Columbia, fully funds doctoral students, or did at the time that I was there. I believe it's still the case. So I didn't have to worry about tuition, and I was given a modest living stipend. I say modest because I was living in New York. Columbia subsidizes apartments for graduate students. So if you're fortunate to get one of those apartments, you can live in the area around Columbia for moderately reduced rate. But I had a hard time feeling like I could live the way I wanted to live on the stipend that was available to me. So I did a few different things. I knew that I don't thrive in a situation where I'm living with roommates unless those roommates are really specific people. So I knew I needed to live in a one-bedroom apartment. That adds costs. I knew that I'm also a person who works well from home. I've been working from home all my professional life. So I knew I needed a space where I could do that. And that meant supplementing my graduate stipend. I worked a few research positions at Columbia. I was a graduate assistant at the Empirical Reasoning Lab. I would teach summer intensive methods courses at the Policy School. But the other thing that I did that I'm really glad that I did was I did a lot of consulting. Once I had that master's en route to the PhD, I hustled that little MA to all kinds of different consulting jobs. I was really fortunate to always be able to find work that either gave me access to data that I could then use in my dissertation, or give me access to data that I could then use towards a publication. So I was always looking for relationships outside of my university that would help advance my skill set or my graduate degree in some way. So I was always trying to work in ways that didn't necessarily detract from my progress because I didn't want to be in graduate school forever either. So I did a lot of research consulting. I said, look, I have these skills as a researcher. That means I'm good at asking questions. Who has questions that they need answered? And I just sought out those people. And eventually I built up a website. I made it possible for those people to seek me out. And I've been really fortunate in that sense. So there's two things that I think consulting does well for graduate students. One is giving you access to data or to things that you can write about in your dissertation or things that you can publish about. The second thing it does is it gives you work experience other than your dissertation. And in an increasingly complicated, fraught, competitive academic job market, being able to talk about the application of your skill set is tremendously important. And I was really proud to have given myself that because if I hadn't ended up in the academic job that I have now, I probably would have pivoted to full-time consulting. And it would have set me up to have something consistent on my resume, showing that I don't just think about theory. I know how to apply the things that I do to real world challenges. It takes some finessing, but if you can figure out how to do it well in graduate school, it can work in all sorts of ways for you.
That's so smart because I also worked outside of graduate school, but none of my work had anything to do with my dissertation. Part of that was intentional because I did need space and time away from the dissertation, but I think it's really strategic to take consulting as one, additional income, two, a data source for your dissertation, but also as professional development and skill sets that make you a more competitive candidate, whether you go on the academic job market or you decide not to go on the academic job market. So really, really smart to do. But you haven't really told us like how you went from the master's to the consulting. Because I feel like when I hear consulting, I'm thinking these like super long and dense cases and you have to study really hard for the consulting interviews. Did you do all of that or like how did you actually do it?
I didn't work for a consulting firm. I think I could have, lots of people do. But I had previous relationships with buddies who worked for organizations, and I would just reach out to people that I knew and say, hey, if you ever need someone to help on the research side of things, I'm available for that. Or occasionally, there would be these little opportunities for one-off things that would come through the listserv at Columbia, and I would just take those opportunities. And then I used every job as an opportunity to build a relationship. When I had a buddy who told me, hey, actually, we've got this thing we're working on at ACLU. Could you just take a look at it? I would always plant that flag of, yeah, and whatever you need in the future, just give me a call. You can always find my contact information on my website and you build those networks out. But I started with relationships that I already had. And I started with things that I knew I could knock it out of the park. And that's not everybody's approach. Some people are like, go big or go home. But I started with, who do I know that might need research? I spent a little bit of time before I started reaching out to those contacts, figuring out for myself, what can I offer? Is it evaluation? Is it research design? Is it policy analysis? And that's when I would reach out to buddies who were running smaller organizations or were part of bigger organizations. And I just had those conversations. I would say, hey, I know you guys deal with a lot of really big challenges. And if you are ever looking for some support on the research side of things, this is what I'm able to offer. And I had to learn that it's okay for people to say no, or not right now, or not yet. But a lot of those not right nows turned into, hey, we're in a pickle later on. So if my name hadn't been in somebody's head milling around as Amber does research, I might not have gotten those calls later on. Don't be afraid to reach out, use the networks that you have, use the contacts that you have, and those people tell their networks. That's how a lot of this happens.
Great advice. Can you remind me, did you go straight from college to the PhD?
I finished college early and I used that time in between to work. So I went into graduate school at the same time that I would have if I had done all 4 years.
But also, when you finished graduate school, you went straight into an academic position. You didn't do a postdoc. So can you talk a little bit about that decision, especially as someone who had their foot into the non-academic world with all of your consulting experience? How did you decide that, one, you absolutely 100% knew that you wanted to pursue an academic position, but also how did you prepare yourself during your doctoral studies so that you were a very competitive candidate for the academic job market?
Ooh, when I tell you I resourced myself, I had my foot in both worlds the whole time. And it sometimes feels like it's not okay to say that. I know that I'm really fortunate to be in a tenure track job. I don't take for granted that's something that is really hard to obtain. I feel really lucky, but I also push back against this idea that in graduate school, you can only aspire to a tenure track appointment. And even as someone with a tenure track job, I think it's just a really limiting way to think that there's one path and it's the correct path and everything else is a deviation from it. We have to do what sets us up to be our full selves and live our full lives. And for some people, that's an academic job. And for other people, it's not. I knew that I needed options. That's what worked for me. So I resourced myself. I went to every workshop I could go to about how to write a cover letter and a CV and do an interview. I went to every workshop that was available. At the same time, I was at the Career Center working on converting my CV to a resume. I was talking to research firms. I was taking interviews. I was doing both job markets simultaneously. And I was exhausted. But I knew that's what I had to do to feel like I had options that made me feel good about the life I wanted to live. Because I also knew I didn't want to take just any job. I wanted to live in a place that could give me the lifestyle and the connections that I wanted to have. I knew I wanted to stay close to my community and my family. So I was already limited geographically in that I knew I wasn't going just anywhere. So I worked hard to figure out how to be at the top of whatever market I was going into. I just took whatever resources were available to me and I ran with it. I did go on the academic job market twice. So I went on the market very selectively. The first time around, I got a couple of interviews for postdocs, but no tenure track offers. The second time I went on the job market, I learned a lot from this experience the first time around. And I was really lucky to have had multiple interviews and multiple offers, which I really didn't expect because I had applied so selectively to places. But even with that selectivity, I applied to probably 50 or 60 jobs, and including Skype interviews, I got probably 7 or 8 interviews. And then I got a handful of offers. I think for anybody, the batting average feels really low on the academic market, but I had to take what I learned the first time around and I was able to be much more competitive. the next time.
I'm so glad that you shared those numbers, because that's another area that's really cryptic for doctoral students. How many jobs should you apply for? How many interviews can you expect? So I'm really glad that you shared the number of applications that you submitted and the number of interviews and a general idea of the number of offers. Because I think that helps manage people's expectations. It's very different from applying to graduate school. You should not apply to 50, 60 graduate schools. That's insane. But for the job market, you have to if you are hoping to have some semblance of a chance. That's just the state of the academic world right now. That's the state of the academic job market. So thanks for the reminder. You talked a little bit earlier about how you create time, make time for yourself, approach your life in a balanced way. Can you just talk a little bit about, especially in the season that we're in, how do you practice self-care? How do you maintain your wellness as much as you can? And how do you separate your work from who you are as a person, your own identity, in a way that is healthy? How do you separate yourself so that it's not the end all be all of who you are?
I feel really strongly that who I am is not what I do. I have to have a sense of who I am outside of my occupation, because people lose their jobs or leave their jobs for all kinds of reasons. And I can't put myself in a position to be in absolute crisis and to have a crisis of identity when those life circumstances happen. For me, that's really important. So I will start right off the bat by saying who I am is not what I do. There's a lot of purpose in what I do, but I've worked really hard to think about what that purpose is outside of the occupation itself. So whether I'm teaching, whether I'm doing research, whether I'm doing work in a community, I know I'm really good at sharing ideas. And so the contribution that I make, no matter what sphere I'm in, is figuring out how to think about problems and how to communicate paths towards solutions. That's what I do. That's what I do as a researcher. That's what I do as a teacher. That's what I do in community building. No matter where I am, I'm always thinking about how do I infuse my purpose in this job, right? How do I help people think critically about really challenging things and help them communicate those ideas so that we can push the ideas forward? That's my purpose. And that's who I am. That's what I carry with me from one job to the next thing to the other thing. It always centers around how do I help people think, right? Like, how do we think about problems? And in doing that, I think the other thing I really care about is helping people find that in themselves, feeling a sense of fulfillment because you know what contributions you have to make to the world around you. It's really easy to feel like a career is the thing that matters, because in many ways it is, right? A career is the thing that gives you money. A career is the thing that people ask you, what do you do, when they meet you? And I find myself, especially now, pushing back on that a little bit. I think it's good and it's healthy to find a sense of fulfillment in your job. Nobody wants to be in a job that makes them unhappy. But to feel a sense of purpose and a sense of drive beyond the thing that gives you the paycheck is what has really empowered me to not feel limited just to the job that I do. Having this mindset has really allowed me to expand my thinking of where my contributions lie. And it makes me feel like my whole life isn't tethered to the job itself. So in that sense, speaking to the other part of your question, which is about self-care, that makes it easier for me to protect the boundary of where can my work breach? Because if the work is not the core of how I see myself and who I am, then I have to have things that protect it from becoming that. It goes on my syllabus. Dr. Spire answers emails from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. If you have questions outside of that time, you can expect it to be answered the following business day. It just is starting to become second nature. Like when I put my work down for the day, I put it down, I go make dinner, I spend time with my family. I'm able to give myself that breathing room because I feel a strong sense of who I am. I know what it's like to have lost that and to have felt really consumed by work and by other things, by life circumstances. And now that I'm in a place of coming back to myself and taking more ownership of my mental health and taking more ownership of my own process, I find myself being really protective of that breathing room. I have to maintain it, because if I don't, I can't even do the work. If I don't have that breathing room in my life, I can't even show up to the job that I care about to keep doing what I do. So it's something that works all the way around, but it is, for me, really important to maintain.
Thank you again for listening to this week's episode of the Cohort Sistas podcast. If you are a Black woman interested in joining the Cohort Sistas membership community, or you're looking for more information on how to support or partner with Cohort Sistas, please visit our website at www.cohortsistas.com. You can also find us on all social media platforms at Cohort Sistas. Don't forget to subscribe to the Cohort Sistas podcast and leave us a quick review wherever you're listening. Thank you so much for joining us this week, and we'll catch you in next week's episode.